All right, and we're back. I think we're going to talk about app model now and how that works. And that's going to cover everything from as far as what's actually contained in the application package and what that means to process lifecycle, and then a little bit just by necessity of how to run applications in the background and do stuff in the background.
We threw everything we couldn't fit anywhere else, we threw it here.
It was an app model, yep. Right. We have this fancy graphic of Windows Store app acquisition. And basically what this is showing is every app as you get it from the store basically is downloaded in a zip package. And within that zip package is a whole bunch of stuff. And what happens at install time is a very deterministic process where basically that zip is unpacked and things that can be deterministically undone are done to install that application. So what that means is when the user uninstalls your app, it can be guaranteed that nothing that nothing can be left over. There's no side effects left after the uninstall. And so you can see there's the stage and register step that basically installs this application for you. And so moving on, this is what actually is contained in that zip. It's the app package, if you will. And the most important thing that we'll look at more closely here in a demo soon is this app manifest. And basically what this is it's the thing that tells Windows what your app can do, what its capabilities are, what its contracts are, and basically everything else about it. It's also where you specify your launch images, splash screen images, all of that stuff. Very much similar to info.plist in iOS.
Yep.
And then there's this block map, which is really important, and that's basically it contains hashes of everything inside the app package, and it's what allows updates to happen pretty easily. If you issue a new update to your application and put it up on the store, your block map will be compared to the new update on the store, and you'll only download the pieces that you need, and then your app will be patched with that new information. And then the signature, in combination with this block map, are used to ensure the integrity of the application package. So basically, after you've downloaded it, you can't go in there and modify or mess with anything of that app and still have it run. It's how the security of it's guaranteed.
Yep, and this is all transparent to the developer. You submit your application to the store, mm-hmm. we deploy it for you, we install it, we uninstall it, like Windows, the platform is doing all of that. So it's very much like iOS where, you know, they do all the work for you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so, just to start with that, this is the app bundle in iOS. It's a pretty similar concept. As you can see, if we're actually looking inside the bundle, this is a screenshot out of one of the B&R books, the homeowner application, homepwner. There's the actual executable itself, and then there's the nibs, which are used for the views. Then there's the info plist, which, as we said earlier, is kind of like the manifest in that it tells what the app can do. And so the situation in looking at a Windows package is very much the same. We can see here at the bottom we have this exe, that's the actual executable. And then there's also these XAML files, which, just like the nibs, they get redistributed with the application and are parsed at runtime and turned into their classes, as we saw earlier in the XAML stuff. And then there's also the app manifest is in there as an XML file, and then there's the block map in XML. And again, all of these are just, this is just the inside of what your app is actually installed as. And so, again, just a little bit more on the manifest. This is the place where if you said wanted to access the user's music library or pictures library, you would say, I want access to that here. Also, if you want to use devices or internet or access GPS or any other sensors like that, you would declare this in the manifest. It's a security thing. It lets the user know what's going to happen to your application, and they can also revoke these privileges on a per-privilege, per-app basis.
Yep. Right.
And we'll see when we get to a demo the editor that's provided for AppX manifest, so you're not sitting there editing XML by hand.
Yep. And the beauty of having the capabilities, not only is it asking at runtime, because, you know, you're like, if you compare it to the iOS world, where at iOS, when you're about to use webcam, iOS comes up and says, hey, do you want to allow them to use webcam? What we do with the manifest that is also when you go to the store, we give you that information.
Right.
So before you download an application, we tell you, oh, you're about to download an application. Like, imagine you go in there and you try to download a Sudoku game. And it's saying, oh, it's going to want access to your documents library and
to your location,
location and everything else. You can go back and be like, hey, that looks suspicious. Maybe I shouldn't install it.
Right.
So that's what we do. We use that for certification. If you gave us that Sudoku game and you would try to access documents library, we probably would fail it or we would question the developer a lot.
Right.
So that's, you know, it kind of adds up to that confidence that we want users to have that they're not going to break.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So.
And so this is just another thing that comes along with the whole app package and the way everything's set up, and that is complete and total process isolation. Again, on iOS, this is a very similar situation in that no process can know about each other. They have a separate context that they're running in as far as file access and storage, and then in addition to that, they have a separate networking context as well. So even if you somehow built a server into your like Windows Store application, you could not talk to another app using that server. Or anything like that, because there's separate network context to keep everything directly separated. However, as we'll see in the next session that Jaime's going to do, there is a way to shuffle data or information between different apps, and that's contracts. However, these are brokered by WinRT itself rather than by each app knowing about another app. You just tell the system that you want to expose certain information or that you want to receive certain information, and WinRT handles that for you. And so this is just a way to keep everything secure. So, that being said, let's go ahead and open up Visual Studio and just look at that capabilities, manifest editor, and everything like that. Actually, I had a camera demo for this. So, this actually opened right up into the manifest editor. And this is an SDK sample from Windows, from MSDN, and that's going to show us some camera capture. We'll see that in a moment. But here is the application UI section of this manifest. We can specify our display name. This is what will appear on the start menu. We can specify the entry point. That's the class that it should look for and load. Language, that's internationalization stuff. You can specify your orientation preferences, like the launch orientation, iOS kind of thing. And then here is a whole bunch of different images that you get to specify for your tiles and logos, store logos, all of that kind of stuff. You should totally be familiar with that. And then there's this capabilities tab. And here in this application demo, there's webcam and microphone are already checked. If we uncheck these and run this application, you'll see that when we click this capture photo button, it's going to say we need permission to use the camera. And it says you can change this in the app settings. However, since we didn't request it, permissions, okay. It says this app does not use any system capabilities because we didn't specify that in our manifest. So if we go back in here and tell it to use webcam and microphone, those two are kind of a pair usually on most systems, and run this again, and we hit capture photo, we now are prompted because we requested the capability, and we can hit allow here, and you'll get this awkward shot of us from way back here. Great quality, excellent quality.
That's how bright it is, they could see the light.
And so we can also, even though we have declared this in our manifest, the user, again, all of these permissions, they can revoke them on a per app basis, so I just turned it off, and now, since I actually declared that properly in my manifest, it's there and it's a switch that I can use. Simple stuff.
And that UI was added by the system, so you didn't have to do anything to go back on the settings. You didn't have to go anything to add it to turn it on and off.
Absolutely. This UI, this is not written as part of the application. This is just WinRT reading our manifest and saying, oh, I'm going to provide this switch to the user.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So let's go back to our slides.
Show them, close that one there, or go to Solution Explorer. Show them the XML version if you want. I thought it was interesting. Okay. So just right-click, yep.
Yeah, just so if you're curious, and you just want to, or if you're feeling particularly masochistic, and you want to go in here and edit XML manually, you can see what it looks like. Basically, we specify a package as our root element, and then all of those other things kind of are fairly obvious there. Eventually, we get to applications. A package can contain more than one application. And you can see where everything that we set up in that manifest, the kind of visual editor, is reflected here.
Yep.
So, pretty simple. And there's the min version, max version, all that fun stuff that you would tend to expect. also identity. It's a good one too. All right, so let's get out of that and go back. So that was just kind of how everything works, or as far as acquisition of the app package and installing it. So that kind of brings us into the application lifecycle now. So this is when your app is running, or not running, or in any state, the user's interacting with your app. How do you basically know what states you're in, and how do you basically save information and deal with the different application states? Because again, these are resource-constrained devices. It's not like you can just have a window in front of it. So on iOS, we have these five states. There's a chart that I'm sure most people watching this have seen, where there's these states: not running, active, inactive, background, and suspended, where we have various different things that the app could be doing. So if it's visible, receiving events, or executes code. The active state is when that active app is in the foreground, and it's visible, receiving touch events, and also executing code. And this is the direct analog to the running state on Windows Store apps, which is when the app is in the foreground, and that's what the user's seeing and currently interacting with. The not running state is also direct analog, where that's the app's just not running at all. It's not in memory. It's just terminated, gone. Right. And then there's the inactive state on iOS, which that state only exists for the case where, say, a modal dialog appears over the app that you're using. So we have mostly visible here and not receiving events. But that's just because the app is still there. It's what's
like
the
phone
one that's
call.
Running. Right, exactly. A phone call or something like that. But your app can still be running in the background. So if you're generating primes, then by all means, yeah, it's still working. And that is not the case on Windows Store apps because we don't have any sort of those modal interruptions or anything like that. The same is similar situation for the background state on iOS app. There is not an equivalent state for that on store apps because that's background tasks, which are an entirely different concept that we'll cover at the end of this, but are technically a contract. But we'll see more about those soon. And then there's the suspended state, and this is also a direct equivalent between iOS and Windows Store apps, where the app is just freeze-dried, canned in memory, not really doing anything, not receiving events or executing any code, but everything is still cached in RAM. It has not been taken out of memory. And then on Windows Store apps, there's also these two additional states that we'll see why they exist here soon, but that's terminated and closed by user. And those states they're roughly equivalent to not running, but when you're coming back from those states, you're going to want to do things a little bit differently, and there's a table that makes that very clear soon. So this is the actual application lifecycle for Windows Store apps. The vast majority of the time, you're only going to be concerned with this circle on the right hand here, where your app is, say, terminated and not running. It gets activated. The user taps your tile. You go into the running state. Then the user navigates away from that application, suspends, and you go into the suspended state. Right. There's some subtleties in here that we'll deal with soon, but like this whole left side. But the vast majority of the time, you're going to be over here worrying about the three states: running, suspended, and terminated. So to highlight some more on those states, there's this nice little animation here. All right. Whoops. Go away. OK. So the user launches the application. They start by seeing the splash screen. The splash screen goes over, and the app is now running. It's in the running state. They're interacting with it. They're doing anything they want to the app. Then there's the suspending event that happens. And this is the notification to that running app that, all right, you're getting ready to not be running anymore. You'll no longer be able to execute code. And that's in the suspended state. No code runs.
So, and you go into suspended. So we have one foreground app. You can go into suspended when the user switches to another app.
Right.
Right. So you're kind of going from the foreground to to something
right.
else.
From the foreground to no longer on screen.
Yep. Exactly.
Yes. Because there is the case where the apps could be snapped next to each other, and two apps could be in the running state at the same time.
Yep. Exactly.
But when the app is no longer on screen is when it is suspended.
Yep. Perfect.
And so then from suspended, the application could be resumed immediately. So this would probably be the example where, I actually have another animation coming up to show it, but the user switches away from your app to check their mail or something for a very short amount of time, and there's, you're not running a lot of other apps and the system isn't constrained, so it just keeps your app there freeze-dried and RAM. However, if resources are tight and your app's been suspended for a little bit, there is the case that it will be terminated. And that's when it's dropped out of memory to free up memory for other applications, and you'll have to restore from scratch. So, just to kind of seal the deal on that, this suspending event, which we'll look at more closely soon in code, you have 5 seconds to handle suspension. And that's 5 seconds of real time or CPU time.
No, that's 5 seconds real time.
Real time, right.
So from when the we fire suspended, we call onto your suspension handler. So you can wire up to the event and you'll get 5 seconds. You can make an async call and get a deferral if you want to, but you'll get 5 seconds of real time.
Okay.
Technically, if you really need more than that, first of all, you should not need more than 5 seconds because you should save state as you go along.
Right.
That's better. And if you need more than that, the trick is you can also listen to visibility change because visibility change will fire 10 seconds before we suspend you. So you can be like, oh, I'm no longer visible. And then what we do there is we actually wait 10 seconds. And you probably shouldn't be assuming on these numbers because they might vary. These are system numbers. But and then after that, we call on to suspend it. And the reason we do those 10 seconds is because, for example, sometimes I'm doing Windows Tab to switch across apps. And I kind of switch to something and then come back immediately where I do it by accident, like I've done it many times today.
Yeah.
So that's what you'll see. You'll see that those 10 seconds will buy you some time. It's a great place to start saving if you really need it.
And actually, a question just came in. And so if an app is busy loading something from the net and the user switches away to check mail, the loading is stopped until it is released from suspended.
Yes.
Yes, that is correct. However, if you are downloading something big from the net, as we'll see in a bit, background tasks will be the way you'll want to deal with that.
Yep. For file transfer, we have background file transfer, download and upload. And those background APIs.
And that's managed
APIs,
by WinRT.
Yeah, those are WinRT APIs, and you don't even have to write a background task. You can also write your own background task, but for background file transfer, we give you the API.
Absolutely. All right. And so moving on, this is just another illustrative example that can show what can happen when running multiple apps and their switching of states between running suspended and terminated. So we start with this one app that is in the running state. And then we switch to app 2 that is now in the foreground. This is app 2 is what the user is interacting with. And then after that 5 seconds that we saw earlier, app 1, it goes to suspended. We then switch to a third app. App 3 is now in the foreground. And it moves to suspended and so on and so forth. Eventually, though, as we get further on into app N, it's partly deterministic, but apps can be terminated. And there's no notification from the suspended state to the terminated state. So everything that you're going to have to do to save state has to happen between running to suspended, because your app's not receiving any cycles or any sort of notification. This is a little different than what could be the case in iOS, where you'll get messages about each of these state transitions and the chance to run code. It's essentially the same thing. And so we switch back to app 2, which was never suspended, and now it's back in the running state. There was no need to restore state manually. So that's kind of that. All right, so that's the theory of it. Here's how you might actually go about saving state. So there's this thing called Suspension Manager. It's a class that's included with a lot of the templates in Visual Studio when you're creating Windows Store apps. I highly recommend using it. Even if you make the blank app template, you should still pull the Suspension Manager from somewhere and use it along with its counterpart layout aware page. So basically, Suspension Manager, as we'll see soon, is just a big dictionary for all intents and purposes with some functionality. So here we have we're getting a reference to the Suspension Manager, which is available in the common namespace from the templates. And we're basically just storing game status in the dictionary under the key game status. And then to restore, we just pull it out when everything's good. So that, like, we do that, so when does that actually happen or become anything? An app XAML.cs, this is like the equivalent of your app delegate. This is where we would register, subscribe to this event with our onSuspending handler, and we would say, all right, we're going to acquire our deferral. This is what lets us basically run potentially asynchronous code from within this onSuspending event and not have Windows kill our app before everything's actually done. And so we would. This is all generated in the templates for you, but suspensionmanager.saveAsync is called. And what this does is basically takes that dictionary, which you can store primitive types, and serializes it all out to a file and saves that to local storage. And because it's doing all of that, it's an asynchronous operation, and we call it with the await keyword. Right? And then once that's done, we'd complete our deferral. Relatively simple. So again, this is that session state dictionary that Suspension Manager owns. It also, we were in this slide, we were just writing to it directly with our own values. But back in this slide, you can see that it also holds for each layout aware page that is a member of like the application. It also has a dictionary that is the page state. So each page will have its own dictionary. And moving on, we can see that every layout aware page subclass, which is what you should be using, has these method stubs, save state, load state on them. And basically, each one's passed in the page state dictionary that comes from Suspension Manager. And what you do is you store just the same things in there. So here we have page state dictionary. We're adding our greeting output text to it, and then we're adding the value of our greeting output text block into that. And then restoring state, we're doing the exact same thing. This save state method will be called, thinking back to the navigation stuff that I talked about earlier, the save state gets called when you navigate away from a page. So this happens automatically just by implementing this method. Every time you navigate away from a page, save state will be called and you can save to this dictionary. And then if your app gets suspended or terminated, this will all be serialized out. And then when you resume from the terminated state, you'll get this load state method will be called when you navigate to the page and supplied with the page state dictionary that you can then use to set text on like the UI or something like that. And of course, if page state is null, that means it's the first time your application's been run and you should do whatever it is you need to do to set up your data and redo it manually. Yep. All right. So back to these terminated and closed by user state, or not running and closed by user states versus terminated. Essentially, terminated, when you're checking your previous execution state, which is done in app.xaml, this is where you want to restore your session data. So this is where you would call Suspension Manager restore async and basically let it populate all of those dictionaries again so that your application will continue to function with all of these pre-canned values. However, if the previous execution state was closed by user or not running, you're not going to want to restore that data. Because that means that the user either explicitly closed the application, which means that they're going to want to see that splash screen again, or that the application crashed, or it's the first time running, and you're going to want to basically remake all of your data.
Yep.
All right. Cool. And so just kind of on the same note, this is storing user preferences. This is a very similar situation as it is to iOS on for NS user defaults. And that is basically just another dictionary, except this can be local or it can be roaming. And that works exactly how you might imagine it. The local settings are specific to the device that that user's on, and the roaming settings are global. Any app that have installed on multiple different devices, say on the Surface, if I had mail installed, and if on my computer I had mail installed, and I was changing settings and sync settings on them, I would expect those settings to be the same on both devices. And so that's how you can do that. Code's fairly straightforward.
Yep, and the roaming is done all automatically. The system does it all for you.
Exactly.
Just give it your live ID, or the user has to have the live ID enabled, and then we will roam them across devices as they go.
Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, that's all managed by Microsoft servers, and it's not really instant, but it's probably about 10 minutes it takes for the everything to sync up.
Yep.
Okay.
And the one caveat with that is there is limits. Like, don't try to run books or anything like that. Usually, this is for settings. So an application will, you know, we tell people by default try to run less than 32K.
Right.
So just make sure you're saving just settings. Don't try to save a document that we're working on or anything like that.
You can't be putting pictures or anything in here. This is just preferences.
Yep.
These are things that you use to basically shape your app kind of thing.
Exactly.
Right. It's not for data, not at all. SkyDrive integration is what you'd want to use for that.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Perfect.
So, all right. I believe that it's time for the suspending and resuming demo. All right. So this here, there we go, is a very, very basic application that is nothing but a button hooked up to a timer, hooked up to a text box. And we're gonna walk through the suspending and resuming events and show them in the debugger. Let's see, where's the code behind? And suspend and resume. All right. So just to, you know, give you some context on the code, we have a basic dispatcher timer, which is a timer that runs on the main thread. We set up a tick event for it that basically updates the text block every so often, every interval, which I believe I have set to 100 milliseconds. Yes. And we have that wired up. So if we run this and put it next to Visual Studio, okay, we can see that it is there counting, still counting. And so we're going to suspend this around 7 seconds. Okay, well, no, I missed it. All right, well, 8.4 is what it looked like there. So right now the app is in the suspended state, which this is kind of debugged, so it's a little bit weird. You would never normally have an app that still had a position on screen that was in the suspended state, but because we're in the debugger, we get to do that. So if I resume, you can see it picked up right where the timer left off because everything was just freeze-dried. Nothing changed. Okay? And it's really that simple.
Trying to say zooming, oh. Yep.
Oh, okay. All right. That should be a little bit more readable, I hope.
Yep.
Maybe? Okay, cool. And so what we can see in here is that we have this onSuspending event. And we hit this onSuspending event. And this 5 seconds rule that is normally applied to these Windows startups doesn't apply when you're debugging the application. Otherwise, that would get really frustrating really fast. So we have infinite time here to basically poke around this. And right, you can see that by this blank template that does not include the suspension manager, there's no save async in here, but we can open up a new app and show that in a moment. But yeah, that's it, suspending. Continue running it, suspended. There's also the on resuming event, which we are not currently subscribed to, but we can subscribe to it real quick.
You'll have to stop.
So this is going to throw an exception when we do it, but oh well. Suspend. There's our unsuspending message. All right, then we resume. And here's app resuming. And let's just throw that exception and get it over with. All right. So that's pretty much it. Just to show a little bit about Suspension Manager. Okay. You'll see it generates, when we use anything other than the blank template, we get this whole big common folder that's filled with lots of goodies. Suspension Manager is one of them. That's big enough, I think, maybe? Okay. And we can see our save async method here, where basically we iterate over each frame, or page rather. Frame is just the superclass of page. And we call this method save frame navigation state on each frame. And if we go to the definition of that, there it is. Okay. We save that into the frame state dictionary. Right.
Yep.
And that is pretty much it. All right, that's Suspension Manager. I don't see any questions sitting in here, so. Okay, with that, we'll move on. So the background state is something that we don't exactly have an equivalent to. We're actually doing activations now, sorry. Okay, so in addition to the PLM and like state, there's also activations. These are basically different things that your app can do, like different intents almost. In iOS, there's only one other type of activation, and that's a URL activation, other than the app user just clicking on the app icon from the home screen. That's that your app can be opened with a URL, and the path for it looks like this. The app goes from not running into URL activation, no, then it just application did become active, and then it's in the running state. If there was a URL provided, then it first goes into this application handle open URL, and then that's your chance to basically deal with that URL and then open your app in the right way. Right. Windows Store apps is a little bit different because of contracts and because, you know, your app it's no longer just the app that you can launch from the start screen. It's much more powerful. And so we have all these different places for activations. And looking at that graph, that can be a little bit confusing, but it's actually really not that confusing. Activation by contract is the way you'd want to think about this. And so here's just a big list of a bunch of different contracts that Jaime is going to cover a few select ones in the next session. But basically, when your app is invoked with one of these contracts in mind, the idea is you don't want to present your normal UI, or you don't want your app to act like the user tapped on the tile from the start screen. You want it to do something different. So with that being said, on launched is your normal event. That's what you're going to get. That's the message that will happen if the user taps on your application from the start screen. It's the normal standard flow. All of these other activations, and this probably isn't a complete list. In fact, I know it's not. There's other activations as well, but these are mutually exclusive to on launched and mutually exclusive to each other. Whereas in iOS, you saw we had a path that was like the same, even if it was a URL. We got certain messages that happened despite the fact that there was no URL or was a URL. Here, we get messages per activation. So if you get activated by a file picker contract, you'll get the file activated or message. And what you'd want to do here is not do any of the restoration of state or saving of state. You'd want to do something totally different that is specific to that contract.
Yep. And you don't have to handle. So this is if you're implementing the contract. If you're not implementing the contract, then none of this will fire, and you'll have a very trivial on-launch the way you have in iOS.
Right, absolutely. Anyway.
Yep.
Yeah, this is not compulsory by any means. The only one that is compulsory is on-launched. The rest of these are opt-in, and you'll never get these messages unless you declare them in the contracts tab of that manifest.
Yep.
All right. So, all right, that's background, or that's activations. Now we're on to background tasks. So this is a contract, as we talked about earlier. It's what you use to basically stay alive in the background kind of thing. This is, example apps would be like Skype or something, where you're chatting and you want real-time communication, or mail if you want it to keep updated, or like a text messaging application even, if you want to get push notifications, right. So this is a screenshot of the manifest editor again, and here it's just showing that we've added a background task as a contract, and we've specified a few different options for that, and we'll explain what all of those mean here soon. Right. So this is some code to register for a background task. There's this object called the background task builder that you use to basically create your background task. It lets you specify name, entry points. All of this needs to line up with what you specified in the manifest too. And then it also lets you specify triggers. In this case, we're specifying a time trigger of 15 minutes. And that second parameter there is one shot, which is, should this be repeat or should it happen only once? In this case, we've specified true for one shot. And then builder set trigger, we're setting a trigger on it. And the rest of that is a condition, which we're saying in addition to the trigger, we also want there to be a condition on internet available. And so the way that works is if after 15 minutes when this timer trigger fires, we only want our background task to run if in addition to that there's internet available. If there's not internet available, then our trigger or our background task will be latched and run the next time there is internet available. Right. And then finally, we call register on that background task that we've just created. And that registers it with WinRT and says, here's this background task available from this namespace and class, this came from a Flickr app, actually. So that's how you would register for one. And this would be the actual implementation of a background task. Background tasks need to be sealed because they're basically WinRT components. And so what you do is there's only one required method of the iBackground task interface, and that's run. Well, only one method at all because there are no optional methods. And what we're doing here is just some pretend work where we're getting something from the web. It could take a while. We're taking it, writing it out to a file, and then we're updating a live tile. That's a pretty typical situation of what you'd want to do in a background task. And so this, as specified earlier, would get run every 15 minutes only if there's internet available. Okay. All right. And so this is kind of a graph that should show you the background task structure and kind of how background tasks are almost totally separate from the app and managed by the system, really. So the first step is this, is to register your trigger. That's that registration code we just saw. And basically, we set that up. And then we also register the class with the trigger. That's like the manifest that we saw, where you specify the entry point there that has to line up with the registration of the trigger and code. And then after you've done that, it's waiting. The system will then decide whether or not to fire a trigger. And if that is the case, the conditions and conditions and triggers have been met and satisfied, the background task is launched. Okay, and so there are a lot of different types of triggers for background tasks, and there's also this distinction between lock screen apps and non-lock screen apps. By default, lock screens are, they're given much more, or lock screen apps, these are things that can show icons and badges on the lock screen. They're given much more priority over non-lock screen apps, because the idea being that if you're on the lock screen, the user's gonna see that a lot more often. They should say more updated, updated more frequently. And so the time trigger, push notification trigger, and control channel trigger, these are all triggers that require lock screen access. And lock screen access is something that you also clarify or specify in your manifest. So you can't be on the lock screen unless it's specified in the manifest. And then in addition to that, the user has to opt in to putting your app on the lock screen. They can remove it at any time, and you're by no means guaranteed access to be on the lock screen.
Yep. There's only 7 apps in the lock screen per user.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a priority against Skype, Mail, all kinds of other apps.
Right. Yep. So I would probably, you know, not make an app that requires or relies on the fact that it's on the lock screen or something like that. So, you know, we have these time trigger, push notification trigger, control channel trigger. The first two are pretty obvious. Control channel trigger is basically what Skype's going to be using or any sort of real-time communication application. Then our non-lock screen triggers, these are things we can hook into that are called system triggers that let you run when certain events happen. And these don't require that you be on the lock screen. So, for example, if the internet becomes available, be notified of that. And then the rest of these are all fairly obvious. And on top of that, this is not an exhaustive list of triggers. These are just the most frequently used ones. There are some other obscure ones, too. So in addition to all of those other constraints, there's even more constraints because these are battery-powered devices, run low on energy, that kind of thing. So background tasks are constrained both in how frequently they can run and in how much they can do. So there's a CPU quota that if your app is not on the lock screen, you get 1 second of CPU time. And again, this is CPU time, not real time. So that 1 second of CPU time is actually a pretty reasonable amount of time. You can get a lot done then. And that does not count if you're waiting. Like if you have a HTTP connection and you're waiting on something or for the result to come back, that does not count towards your CPU time because that thread's sleeping. And so you get 1 second of the CPU usage every 2 hours if you're not on the lock screen. And if you're on the lock screen, you get 2 seconds every 15 minutes. It's pretty simple. And then in addition, there's a cellular and Wi-Fi quotas. This is an example Wi-Fi quota. There's a formula that you can look up to roughly figure out what it might be. But this would be 1 megabit per second, like real download speed on battery connection. Your data limit will be like 0.469 megs if you're not on the lock screen, which isn't really that much. Or if you're on the lock screen, every 15 minutes for a total of 45 megs daily, and then 0.625 megs every 2 hours, because that's your refresh time if you're not on the lock screen for a total of 7.5 megs daily. And again, as soon as you connect to a power source, these quotas are lifted. All right, well, so that was pretty much it. Just to kind of recap, we went over the app package and model, which was basically just everything from the manifest to what's actually packaged. And then we talked about the process lifecycle. That's state, basically everything you're going to want to do, you want to do in suspending, and you're on suspending of handler for that. Right. Yep. And then background tasks, which basically lets you keep your app updated, fresh, and stay alive.
Yep. And I think one thing that you touched on that, because we're not going to touch on this anywhere else, but we talked about the app model, and we kind of have one foreground app. Mm-hmm. But technically, we are multitasking. Like, you know, there's times when you have multiple apps. You can have multiple apps running.
That's right.
So you, for example, show them SnapView, which is where you have one app that's snapped and one app that's in, you know, kind of the field mode. So you can see that. So this is truly multitasking. You have to be aware of that, and you have to implement it such that your app behaves the right way. Right. So for example, here you have weather and store app in parallel.
Right. Both of these apps are in the running state right now.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And the same thing that we have is you have to look at reentrancy because the other time when you have two apps running kind of is when we, which we'll talk about next, will be when we get into contracts.
Right.
And where you have one app and it's sharing against another app, or even you could have one app and it's sharing against itself, and then you end up with two instances of the app running. So this is truly multitasking, something you should be aware of because it's different from the iOS world.
Right. Like, see, this little charm that just opened up on the side now, this is actually the Mail app that's providing the look and feel of all of this. So
exactly.
Both of these are in the running state right now.
Yep,
right?
Exactly.
Because they're both technically in the foreground as well.
Yep.
You're only not in the running state when you're not in the foreground, although the start menu doesn't count for that. Both of those apps are still in the running state, even though the start menu is on top of them.
Good.
All right.
I don't see any open questions. I saw some, but I think they're closed now. So I don't see any open questions. So I think we take a break now, and then we'll come up for a double header where we do contracts and notification in half an hour each, and you know we get them done in 1 hour. So we can be back in 10 minutes, right?
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.